Hello, and welcome back to DebtWired. I'm Amelia Weitzman, a direct lending reporter at DebtWire Europe. And today, I'm joined by Kirsty Hutchinson and Adam Keynes, who are both private capital partners at McFarlane's. In this episode, we'll discuss the current state of documentation in the European private credit market, and to what extent the gradual loosening of terms is putting direct lenders on the back foot of borrowers. Thank you so much for joining me both. Last month, DebtWire published an analysis on the risks that permissive documentation poses, and it was clear that feelings are definitely mixed. You shared your perspective, Kirsty, that while lenders are becoming more comfortable with looser documentation, it should not be viewed as an overwhelming trend. How would you describe the landscape then of documentation in the mid-market?
Thanks, Amelia, and thanks very much for having us both on this programme. I would describe it as a mixed terrain, and I think to get a handle on that, it might be worth just quite quickly surveying how we got from A to B in terms of where we are now. So historically, in the UK mid-market, loan agreements would have been based upon the standard LMA template documentation, tailored obviously to a greater or lesser extent to reflect borrower-specific circumstances, preferences of lenders, and of course, market conditions. The LMA is a bank-led lender trade body and was premised on large syndicated or rather small bilateral bank loans. And the documentation, which was drafted back in the early 2000s, was pretty tight. Since then, obviously, the most significant development in leveraged financing since the GFC has been the growth of private credit funds, private debt capital as an asset class. And that's gone hand in hand with the growth in private equity driven by the availability of leveraged financing. And what private credit did was disintermediated the bank market in the same way as high yield bonds disintermediated the upper market originally in the US, taking banks out of the equation. And so particularly during the bank and bond retrenchment that we saw post-COVID, post-Ukraine, particularly over 2022 to 2023, credit funds became much more active in the broadly syndicated loan market, which was where loan documentation terms had become much looser in order for those banks active in those large loans to compete with high yield bond terms. And what that's led to is some credit funds becoming more comfortable with some typical broadly syndicated loan, BSL, borrower-friendly terms, which, due to the power of precedent, would then feature in smaller mid-market deals for the same private equity sponsors. And that has led to a trickle-down effect in the market more generally of relaxation on some terms. So what you have currently is a rather dynamic landscape, loan agreements reflecting a trade-off between lender protections and borrower operational freedom, adapted to the relative negotiating power of borrowers and lenders, including the use of precedents, dependent upon the attractiveness of the credit or the sector, the overall competitiveness of the situation, and obviously external macroeconomic and geopolitical factors. So the upshot is strong sponsors with good credits in attractive sectors are able to achieve better pricing, but also more flexible terms than a borrower who doesn't tick all of those boxes.
And Adam, given you act for credit funds and direct lenders, do you take a more concerned approach to loosening documentation, or do you share a similar view?
So I think the starting point is that credit funds have always been very focused on the documentary terms they're entering into as one of the key elements of their transaction underwriting. And I wouldn't say that they are currently taking a more concerned approach than previously, but there are a couple of sort of current dynamics of the mid-market landscape that Kirsty's just outlined that I think are influential in how they are approaching documents at the moment. Firstly, credit funds are currently balancing, sort of more in focus than ever, is a commercial pressure to deploy funds, given their business is taking in and managing their investors' money to achieve a target return, with maintaining control on the borrower group that they're lending to through the documents. As Kirsty said, it's the best credits which are the most competitive, and the lenders interested in those deals are pushed the hardest on terms. Secondly, it depends on what part of the market the prospective lenders are targeting. And we're focusing on the mid-market here, but the mid-market is not homogenous. Lenders still hold more sway in the lower mid-market and in non-sponsored deals than the upper mid-market with strong sponsors. Particularly in the case of non-sponsored deals, the lack of the inherent lack of a sponsor precedent being pushed upon a lender gives a lot more sway to lead the terms and hold the pen the counterpoint, as we sort of alluded to, is in the upper mid-market, most credit funds have now conceded to the trickle-down mentioned by Kirsty, but not always wholesale. And then again, dynamics are different between different processes. So if there is a competitive process where multiple lenders are being run against each other, either to take a sole position or increasingly to pull them together at the end into a small club or syndicate, in some cases, if it's a big deal. And that paired with the proliferation of debt advisors in the lender selection processes means that it can be harder for any single lender to hold ground on all the terms that it would like to. They are pushed a bit to the lowest common denominator, which is obviously what the sponsors are trying to achieve through that process. Reflecting on that, most credit funds are doing two things. They are building out their internal legal teams on the deployment side. Traditionally, they've been heavier on the fund investor-focused side of the business. So now they're hiring primarily lawyers with financing backgrounds or increasingly restructuring specialists. And alongside that, those internal lawyers particularly are creating lists of what I'm going to call red line issues, though we'll return to that, which they try not to accept. And this is all in an effort to ensure a baseline standard in any given deal, maintain consistency across their portfolio as a whole, and to avoid setting any sort of precedent document which can be deployed against them on future transactions. They take the view, I think rightly, that it's always harder to claw back ground conceded than not to give it up in the first place.
And Kirsty, which specific clauses or terms are missing or have been added to documentation in recent months or years that have made the documentation looser?
I think the initial response to that would be where exactly do you start? Because, you know, from a lender perspective, if you open with my position should be LMA, then you know, you might characterize yourself as being the victim of death by a thousand cuts, because there are many, many places in which incremental wins can be made for sponsors or terms can be moved to a more borrower-friendly position than they are in the very lender-friendly base LMA, which is not really, other than structurally, properly regarded as the precedent starting place for a mid-market sponsor-backed deal. But of those many areas, I think I'd probably highlight three. Firstly, financial covenants and related equity cure rights. Secondly, incremental debt, additional debt that's going to be permitted into the secured structure. And thirdly, permitted acquisitions, which is something that sponsors focus on very closely, because not least in part due to the focus that people have placed on being able to make bolt-on acquisitions, add-on acquisitions, particularly over recent years. So if we start with financial covenants and related equity cure rights, cov-lite structures, which people talk about a lot. A cov-lite structure is an absolute lack of any ongoing financial maintenance covenants. They may spring into life at some point, but as a default position, there is no maintenance covenant that a borrower is required to comply with on a quarterly basis. These structures remain less prevalent in mid-market loans, particularly private credit mid-market loans. But most mid-market loans that are not distressed have moved towards covenant-loose documentation, so-called cov-loose documentation. And they contain a single financial maintenance covenant, which is usually a leverage test. And that test can be set with some very significant headroom to a banking base case model. And in addition to that, there will also often be multiple allowances for EBITDA addbacks. So, for example, pro forma adjustments for projected cost savings, synergies from acquisitions, disposals, restructurings, cost saving initiatives, and other quite broadly defined initiatives, plus exceptional items, all of which may or may not be capped and may also be subject to varying degrees of diligence requirements from lenders, ranging from independent third-party providers providing diligence to just a CFO providing a confirmation. You may also find that covenants can be rebased. So rather than staying throughout the life of the loan with the covenant profile that was set out of the box at the start of the transaction, if a lender makes an acquisition of a particular agreed magnitude, then they can have the option to rebase the covenant profiles in order to preserve the original headroom. And then equity cures, which go hand in hand with financial covenants, these have never disappeared. They appeared pre-GFC, they've stayed in place, and they have given sponsors increasing amounts of flexibility. So in its simplest terms, an equity cure allows a sponsor to remedy a financial covenant breach or a prospective financial covenant breach by injecting additional capital. But a sponsor may not actually have to inject additional capital. They may be able to designate an amount for an equity cure. They may have so-called day one cash over funding, which actually may not be cash over funding at all. It may just have been some cash on balance sheet of the target. That amount can be designated to cure a covenant breach or prospective covenant breach rather than new equity actually needing to be injected. And whereas historically a borrower might have been required to make prepayments of loans with the equity injected, now it's unusual for that to be required. So you may achieve a reduction in the debt side of the debt to EBITDA ratio via the equity injection, but you don't have to repay any of the loan. And increasingly, sponsors will be allowed one or more goes at, instead of applying the equity cure amount against the debt side of the equation, applying it against EBITDA, which in a debt to EBITDA ratio gives you a lot more bang for your buck. And also in overall terms, the number of cures permitted and their frequency has also increased. On the permitted debt side, it's now completely customary to have quite extensive rights to incur additional debt through incremental or accordion facilities, which are facilities drafted into the documentation, but just not committed on day one. That debt is usually incurred within the facility agreement, so subject to all of the same restrictions, but a very strong sponsor might be able to agree to put in place a sidecar financing, which allows them to incur that debt, but outside the terms of the facility. Historically, this would have been capped with a number. You know, you can incur X million of additional debt. It's now more typically just capped by a leverage ratio. So if you want to put that debt in place, you have to pass a pro forma leverage ratio test. And when I say pro forma, that obviously will be pro forma for the incurrence of the debt, but also for the completion of the acquisition that's being envisaged to be funded by it. Typically, an incremental facility will be used to make acquisitions. A sponsor may also have a freebie basket, which is an amount of incremental debt that can be incurred without having to pass any leverage test. And that may also be subject to something called a grower mechanic, which is to say that the numerical basket will increase proportionate to the increase in EBITDA beyond the opening level. It'll always be floored at the initial level, so it can decrease again if EBITDA falls, but it's intended to grow. And then a final observation on this is that increasingly we see so-called no worse than conditions. So rather than having a leverage ratio that says you can incur this debt provided that your pro forma leverage ratio does not exceed opening leverage, which will be a specific set ratio, instead it can be you can incur this provided that your leverage is no worse than your leverage at the time that you incurred the incremental, which obviously gives borrowers quite a lot of flexibility. And more, admittedly, much more common in large cap syndicated deals, but it is increasingly appearing in private credit at the upper end. And then finally, as I mentioned, number three, permitted acquisitions. Borrowers have much greater latitude these days in pursuing acquisitions. They are key, often key strategically to sponsors to be able to do, but there's much less conditionality attached to them. So a borrower need only, or the portfolio company need only acquire a sufficient equity to be able to exert control. It doesn't have to be 100% of the target that they're acquiring. There's more geographical flexibility. There's more flexibility in terms of sector. So rather than it needing to be the same business, it can be a similar or a complementary sector or business. And significant amounts of contingent liabilities, so deferred consideration, for example, and negative EBITDA are often also permitted within that mix. So these trends, and I've picked these only three, but they are trends which just highlight a shift towards more flexible and borrower-oriented terms, which in turn is just reflective of the heightened competition amongst lenders and the influence of sponsor-backed borrowers.
And from your side, Adam, are there any clauses that raise alarm bells for lenders, either when included or absent?
Yes, there are. As I said, whilst credit funds and their internal and external counsel do undertake both a holistic and detailed review, looking at the docs as a whole, but also on a much more granular level of terms, this really returns to the red line issues that I mentioned earlier. So along with policing the provisions that Kirsty has pulled out where sponsors push for flexibility, some of which lenders are still pretty allergic to, such as EBITDA cures to leverage covenants where they push back or really like to cap that at a one-time thing, I thought I'd pick out five different focus points for lenders, which are particularly sort of hot topics. So firstly, avoiding what are commonly referred to sort of loopholes or trapdoors for exploitation around leakage out of the obligor group to which they lend and for debt incurrence within the group as a whole. And this is really driven at the moment by the sort of the US-led trend for liability management transactions, which I won't dwell on because we'll come back to that later. Secondly, it's ensuring an effective single point of enforcement. And by that, I mean at the top of the structure, having effective share security between two SPVs that sit above the operating group, so that on an enforcement, you only need to enforce that one share charge and you can capture and take control of or sell or through other means realize value of the group as a whole without having to enforce on a granular basis. And that, with sort of a creditor lawyer hat on, is a fundamental of deal structuring. But we have been faced with some attempts in the last year or two to erode that. But it remains one of the biggest issues for lenders to make sure it's robust in the documents. And this is particularly important in lends to regulated borrower groups or where facilities are being advanced to large multi-jurisdictional groups, where in each case, the lenders are unlikely to get share security through all the group entities, or there may be significant carve-outs from the security for sort of regulatory or cost-benefit reasons. Thirdly, and returning a bit to the topics Kirsty touched on, is EBITDA adjustments and how the synergies that can be applied to the group's EBITDA figure that's reported to the lenders are calculated and capped. And in particular, lenders are really focused on making sure that any agreed day one adjustments, which can be by reference to a quality of earnings report or the base case model that has been prepared for the deal, sit within an overall agreed cap and not on top of it, for obvious reasons, and that those synergies can't effectively be rolled forward in perpetuity by the inclusion of language that talks about synergies of a similar type or following a similar methodology. And that makes the concept, to a lender's eyes, a bit more vague about what is included and what is definitely not included. Fourthly, is what's known as an unrestricted subsidiaries concept. So that is an ability to designate some entities in the group as sitting outside of the control of the finance docs. And again, this is closely tied to policing scope for liability management transactions. But in line, I think, with Kirsty's sort of trickle down of upper market terms into the mid market, in most cases, not on sort of full TLB or high yield terms, we've generally found success in pushing back on that in the mid market. And finally, which is a bit more sort of deal specific, is how buy and build strategies are accommodated. They have been a big feature of the market for the last 5 to 10 years, as sponsors look to buy a good established operating group and then sweep up bolt-ons to make it even bigger. But as those sort of strategies and structures have matured in some cases, lenders have put an increased focus on the unique features that come with them. And primarily that is the future economics and how they will flow through, by which I really mean how the group is going to service deferred consideration and earnout payments that fall in subsequent years, and making sure that they are factored into the model. And also, it's not a documentary point particularly, but making sure there is a robust plan to integrate those newly acquired companies into the existing group and therefore reap the benefit of the synergies that are anticipated.
That leads us on nicely to my next question for Kirsty, which is that you mentioned in the analysis that private credit tends to take a more thoughtful, long-term approach to documentation terms compared with syndicated deals. So please, could you describe what this looks like in practice?
Yeah, I think it's completely fair to say that private credit lenders do often aim to distinguish themselves by adopting a more thoughtful, tailored, longer-term approach to loan documentation in comparison to syndicated deals. They have a smaller, more cohesive lender base, and they place a lot of importance on cultivating deeper and more strategic relationships with their borrowers. So I'll pick three key areas where I think private credit tends to distinguish itself. The first one is, again, financial covenants. Now, you might say it's distinguishing itself by having covenants in the mid-market, where, you know, the upper market, you don't have any, but there will be a covenant in most mid-market deals. And private credit places a lot of emphasis on paying close detailed attention to the way that the covenants are structured. And that's because they're investing themselves. They are investing their own investors' capital over the life of their fund. So they're not looking to syndicate and move the debt off their balance sheet. So they focus on that. And that can look like quite bespoke leverage or interest coverage ratios. And as we've mentioned already, both Adam and I, really very nuanced definitions of EBITDA, all of which is designed to reflect and accommodate the specific operational and strategic requirements of the borrower. And that plays well with sponsors. The second is flexibility in structuring. There are lots of ways that you can be flexible in structuring, obviously, but I think a key way in which private credit distinguishes itself is in accommodating, firstly, at bullet and delayed draw facilities, but also, and this has come into increasing focus post-COVID and in the economic environment that's prevailed since then, very significantly payment in kind optionality. So rather than having to pay all interest in cash, a borrower can have some optionality around choosing to pay some of it in kind, so-called PIK interest, which means that the interest compounds and capitalizes rather than needing to be paid in cash. And obviously, a lender will expect to have a premium in return for foregoing some of its cash pay interest. But this is really attractive to borrowers. It crept into a lot of facilities through the COVID-related wave of amendments. And as the position has normalized, it remains as really attractive for borrowers, that borrowers really like to have optionality to be able to pick some of their cash pay interest as and when they choose to do. It helps to manage cash flows and it gives a significant degree of comfort. And that really is a distinguishing feature, I think, of private credit. And then number three, last but absolutely not least, is, as we've touched upon, long-term relationship focus. So, you know, private credit lenders often emphasize a partnership approach. And that includes offering waivers or amendments during challenging times with the understanding and the very clear understanding that long-term borrower viability benefits all parties. Mentioned COVID a few times. This became a salient feature of COVID. There was a great unanswered question pre-COVID, which was, how will credit funds behave in adverse circumstances when the going gets tough? And the answer was that where sponsors also took a partnership approach, which is to say they would stand behind their portfolio asset, and they would supplement the equity with fresh equity injections, then credit funds certainly showed themselves to be prepared to support borrowers with waivers, amendments, extensions, and indeed additional liquidity where that was needed. What helped with all of that is that direct lenders can make decisions much more quickly than banks with an investment committee process to go through, and also take a longer term view than lenders in a syndicated structure, because they are not looking to move that loan off their balance sheet so they can redeploy. They're looking to partner with and nurture that credit, which is also part of their own investment portfolio throughout its life. The final feature, I think, that plays to that point is that many credit funds are also keen to make equity co-investments alongside sponsors, whether that's directly or whether it's via warrants. Be that as it may, a presence or a potential presence in the equity capital structure certainly does increase alignment between lenders and sponsors, and therefore emphasizes that commitment to the relationship, which plays out very well, both in good times when fresh capital is needed and support for the business is needed, but also in more adverse circumstances where that approach is also to the benefit of both sides of the relationship.
In taking a holistic view of terms, Adam, how can lenders balance flexibility for borrowers with their own risk mitigation? And how much influence does a lender have on the financing terms?
I fully agree with Kirsty here that in the mid-market, the approach taken remains tailored and very dependent on the given situation. I think we've already touched upon the ability of a lender to influence the terms in a deal and by extension, the market as a whole and the dynamics that drive that. So picking up a couple of Kirsty's points from the fund's perspective, it's entirely true that they see the supporting sponsor and their relationship with them as an integral part of their underwriting. And as much as looking at a borrower group, they do look at who the sponsor is, their financial resource, and even, you know, the individuals that they're dealing with there and their track record on deals which may not have gone so well. So that's not necessarily reflected in the day one documentation, but it is obviously a critical dynamic over the life of a deal. And to Kirsty's point about sort of mutual support for a transaction, we've seen an increase recently in sort of equity commitment letters where the sponsor agrees to backstop a further funding need. And in return for a creditor giving a covenant reset, a waiver of a default, as Kirsty said, or that agreement to pick some interest in perpetuity or for a period of time, but also in return for a fund agreeing to put in the next wave of funding into that transaction where some liquidity is needed. And again, to Kirsty's point, the equity sharing features, whether it's a warrant or a growth share or a sort of an upfront co-invest, can be really important for credit funds in assessing whether they want to go into a deal. So absent that, the sort of the inherent feature of a debt transaction is that it is a fixed return. You get your interest rate, yes, it's over a variable SONIA base rate, but you do not get to share in overperformance of the business. But by allowing them a small piece of the equity, you do get to. So that drives the alignment that Kirsty mentioned, but it's also really attractive for funds because it takes them out of that sort of fixed known return model and into that world of equity upside, which is obviously attractive. But across the portfolio as a whole, it can even potentially soften the impact of losses made on other deals. Everyone tries to underwrite not to take a loss on any given deal, but that isn't always possible. And then returning to documents, again, it really depends on the dynamics and what particular part of the mid-market is being looked at. But most lenders would still prefer to hold the pen on the first draft of the finance documents. At the upper mid-market, it's very rarely possible now. So Kirsty will be drafting and, you know, the creditor council would be reviewing. But what creditors can win is an ability to sort of influence the precedent documentation. So where there is a track record with a given sponsor of various deals, it isn't necessarily the case that the precedent to be selected should be the one that is most flexible and gives the sponsor the best terms. And most credit fund portfolios by now include at least one deal which, due to that, the influence of deployment pressure that I mentioned earlier and that search and the competitiveness for good credits is outlying from the ideal terms that the lender would like to be entering into transactions on. So they don't necessarily want to deploy on those terms again into a new opportunity where it might be in a different sector, it might be a smaller, or it might just have other dynamics that are less suited to that document, even if it's with the same sponsor. So if there's a selection of three, trying to focus on the one that's the middle of those three is something that lenders also try to do.
Are there lessons Europe's mid-market lenders can learn from the US or other regions where covenant-lite documentation is more prevalent?
The key takeaways are going to be around, inevitably, balancing flexibility for borrowers with whatever happens to be regarded as adequate risk mitigation for lenders. So aside from, you know, just ensuring a fulsome set of general undertakings around potential leakage or value diminution routes, such as additional indebtedness, disposals, distributions, a few areas where lenders could seek to mitigate the risks of no or fewer financial covenants, which is the key feature of US-style cov-lite documentation, would be, again, and we've touched upon this a number of times, focusing on having a strong relationship with the sponsors. The sponsor has the ability to inject fresh capital where it's needed to stabilize their portcos. So, you know, lenders should be ensuring that they remain committed to supporting the borrower in more challenging times. That plays well with sponsors where you don't have the teeth that as a lender you might want to see in the documentation. That relationship is absolutely key. Secondly, lenders are going to want to ensure that they have very fulsome financial reporting and information rights. Typically, they do in an LMA-style documentation. European borrowers across the range European sponsors are pretty comfortable with providing monthly and quarterly and annual reporting packs. But, you know, that's going to be key because what you want to know is there trouble coming down the tracks and what can we do now to solve for that or head it off entirely? And then third and a linked point is AI. Because if you can use some advanced data analytics to identify risks earlier than you might otherwise be able to do, then that's going to allow lenders to structure deals with fewer covenants while still maintaining visibility on the borrower's health or having some comfort around their ability to maintain visibility on borrower health. So lenders can invest in the tech to monitor cash flows, credit worthiness, and sector-specific risks dynamically with the aim of, you know, pretty early detection of signs of potential default.
I think to date, we haven't seen cov-lite documents sort of fully permeating into the mid-market. But as that boundary between the upper mid and the true upper market continues to blur, I think mid-market lenders are going to find themselves under increasing pressure to accept those terms and those structures. And echoing all of Kirsty's sentiments about flexibility and adaptability, with the exception of definitive prohibitions in their fund documents, which credit funds will manage as best they can, credit funds will consider this as one element alongside all the other features of any given deal. And notwithstanding the phrasing I used earlier about red lines in documentation that lenders can't accept, actually they can and they do. And that is why you get those sort of outlying precedents. But their internal governance and underwriting processes give enough flexibility for them to deploy into a deal where the holistic assessment of a transaction merits it worthy of their capital. What continues to be more important for credit funds is an awareness of the strength or weakness of the documentation alongside the commercial underwriting of the strength and weaknesses of the sponsor and the group, and how in any sort of scenario or endgame planning, because they look to what might go wrong in a deal as well as what might go right, the provisions in the documents may be utilized by a sponsor, and that's the basis on which a credit may be pursued further or not. But documentation will rarely be the sole factor in that.
Well, that's all we have time for in this episode. Thank you both for giving such detailed perspectives on a topic that deserves a lot of clarity. And thank you, listeners. If you've missed any episodes, please visit iTunes or Apple Podcasts to catch up on DebtWired. See you soon.